You must have convinced Carla, Bradley said. She married you, after all.
I never convinced her completely, and she never believed in the bad little kid at all. If she had, she would have been at the trial, and we'd still be married.
He stared through the barrier at Bradley, his eyes dead level.
If she had, she would have been glad that I killed him.
The guard in the corner, McGregor, looked at his watch, removed his earbuds, and stood up.
I don't want to hurry you along, Counselor, but it's 11:30, and pretty soon your client has to be back in his cell for the midday count.
I don't see why you can't count him right here, Bradley said, but mildly. It didn't do to get on the mean side of any guard, and although McGregor was one of the better ones, Bradley was sure he had a mean side. It was a requirement for men charged with overseeing hard cons. You're looking at him, after all.
Rules are rules, McGregor said, then raised his hand, as if to stifle a protest Bradley hadn't made. I know you're entitled to as much time as you want this close to his date, so if you want to wait around, I'll bring him back after count. He'll miss his lunch, though, and probably you will, too.
They watched McGregor return to his seat and once more replace his earbuds. When Hallis turned back to the plexi barrier, there was more than a trace of a smile on his lips. Hell, you could probably guess the rest. Although Bradley was sure he could, he folded his hands on his blank legal pad and said, "Why don't you tell me anyway?" 6. I declined the part of Harold Hill and dropped out of drama club. I had lost my taste for acting. During my final year at Pitt, I concentrated on my business classes, especially accounting, and Carla Winston. The year I graduated, we were married. My father was my best man. He died 3 years later. One of the mines he was responsible for was in the town of Louisa. That's a little south of Ironville, where he still lived with Nona McCarthy, Mama Noni, as his housekeeper. The mine was called Fair Deep. One day there was a rock fall in its second parlor, which was about 200 feet down. Not serious. Everyone got out fine. But my father went down with a couple of company guys from the front office to look at the damage and try to figure out how long it would take to get things up and running again. He never came out. None of them did. That boy keeps calling, Noni said later. She had always been a pretty woman, but in the year after my father died, she bloomed out in wrinkles and dewlaps. Her walk turned into a shuffle, and she hunched her shoulders whenever anyone came into the room, as if she expected to be struck. It wasn't my father's death that did it to her. It was the bad little kid.
He keeps calling. He calls me a nigger bitch, but I don't mind that. I've been called worse. That kind of thing rolls right off my back. What doesn't is him saying it happened because of the present I gave your father. Those boots, that can't be true, can it, Georgie? It had to have been something else. He had to have been wearing his felts. He never would have forgotten his felts after a mine accident, even one that didn't seem serious.
I agreed,
but I could see the doubt eating into her like acid.
The boots were Trail Man specials. She gave them to him for his birthday not 2 months before the explosion in Fair Deep. They must have set her back at least $300, but they were worth every penny. Knee-high, leather as supple as silk, but tough. They were the kind of boots a man could wear all his life and then pass on to his son. Hobnail boots, you understand. and nails like that can strike sparks on the right surface, just like flint on steel. My dad never would have worn nail boots into a mine where there might be methane or fire damp. And don't tell me he could have just forgot, not when he and those other two were toting respirators on their hips and wearing oxygen bottles on their backs. Even if he had been wearing the specials, Mama Noni was right. He would also have been wearing felts over them. She didn't need me to tell her. She knew how careful he was. But even the craziest idea can work its way into your mind if you're lonely and grief-stricken, and someone keeps harping on it. It can wriggle in there like a blood worm and lay its eggs, and pretty soon your whole brain is squirming with maggots. I told her to change her phone number, and she did, but the kid got the new one and kept calling, telling her my father had forgotten what he had on his feet, and one of those hobnails struck a spark, and there went the old ball game. "Never would have happened if you hadn't given him those boots, you stupid black bitch." That's the kind of thing he said, and probably worse that she wouldn't tell me. Finally, she had the phone taken out altogether. I told her she had to have a phone living by herself like she did, but she wouldn't hear of it. She said, "Sometimes he calls in the middle of the night, Georgie. You don't know how it is, lying awake, listening to the telephone ring, and knowing it's that child. What kind of parents he has to let him do such things, I can't imagine." "Unplug it at night," I said. She said, "I did, but sometimes it rings anyway." I told her that was just her imagination, and I tried to believe it, but I never did, Mr. Bradley. If that bad kid could get hold of Marley's Steve Austin lunchbox and know how badly Vicky messed up her tryout and about the Trailman specials, if he could stay young year after year, then sure, he could make a phone ring even if it was unplugged. Bible says the devil was set free to roam the earth, that God's hand would not stay him. I don't know if that bad little kid was the devil, but I know he was a devil. Nor do I know if an ambulance call could have saved Mama Noni. All I know is that when she had her heart attack, she couldn't call for one because the phone was gone. She died alone in her kitchen. A neighbor lady found her the next day. Carla and I went to the funeral, and after Noni was laid to rest, we spent the night in the house she and my father had shared. I woke up from a bad dream just before daybreak and couldn't get back to sleep. When I heard the newspaper flop on the porch, I went to get it and saw the flag was up on the mailbox. I walked down to the street in my robe and slippers and opened it. Inside, there was a beanie with a plastic propeller on top. I fished it out, and it was hot, like the person who'd just taken it off was burning up with fever. Touching it made me feel contaminated. But I turned it over and looked inside. It was greasy with some sort of hair oil, the old-fashioned stuff hardly anyone uses anymore. There were a few orangey hairs sticking in it. There was also a note, printed the way a kid might do it, the letters all crooked and slanting downhill. The note said, "Keep it. I have another one." I took the goddamn thing inside, tweezed between my thumb and index finger, that was as much as I wanted to touch it, and stuck it in the kitchen wood stove. I put a match to it and it went up all at once, kafloomp. The flames were greenish. When Carla came down half an hour later, she sniffed and said, "What's that awful smell? It's like low tide." I told her it was most likely the septic tank out back, full up and needing to be pumped. But I knew better. That was the stink of methane. Probably the last thing my father smelled before something sparked and blew him and those two others to kingdom come. By then I had a job with an accounting firm, one of the biggest independents in the Midwest, and I worked my way up the ladder pretty quickly. I find that if you come in early, leave late, and keep your eye on the ball in between, that just about has to happen. Carla and I wanted kids, and we could afford them, but it didn't happen. She got her visit from the Cardinal every month just as regular as clockwork. We went to see an OB in Topeka, and he did all the usual tests. He said we were fine, and it was too early to talk about fertility treatments. He told us to go home, relax, and enjoy our sex life. So that's what we did, and 11 months later, my wife's visits from the Cardinal stopped. She had been raised Catholic and stopped going to church when she was in college, but when she knew for sure she was pregnant, she started going again and dragged me with her. We went to St. Andrew's. I didn't mind. If she wanted to give God the credit for the bun in her oven, that was okay with me. She was in her sixth month when the miscarriage happened. Because of an accident that wasn't really an accident. The baby lived for a few hours, then died. It was a girl. Because she needed a name, we named her Helen, after Carla's grandmother. The accident happened after church. When Mass was over, we were going to have a nice lunch downtown, then go home where I'd watch the football game. Carla would put her feet up and rest and enjoy being pregnant. She did enjoy it, Mr. Bradley. Every day of it, even early on when she was sick in the mornings. I saw the bad little kid as soon as we came out. Same baggy shorts, same sweater, same little round boy tits and poochy belly. The beanie I found in the mailbox was blue, and the one he was wearing when we came out of the church was green, but it had the same kind of plastic propeller. I'd grown from a little boy to a man with the first threads of gray in his hair, but that bad little kid was still 6 years old, seven at most. He was standing back a little way. There was another kid in front of him, an ordinary kid, the kind who would grow up. He looked stunned and afraid. He had something in his hand. It looked like the ball on the end of the bolo bouncer Mama Noni gave me all those years ago. "Go on," the bad little kid said, "unless you want me to take back that $5 I gave you."
"I don't wanna," the ordinary kid said. "I done changed my mind."
Carla didn't see any of this. She was standing at the top of the steps and talking to Father Patrick, telling him she had enjoyed his homily. It had given her so much to think about. Those steps were granite, and they were steep. I went to take her arm, I think, but maybe not. Maybe I was just frozen, the way I was when Vicky and I saw that kid after her lousy tryout for the Music Man. Before I could unfreeze or say anything, the bad little kid stepped forward. He reached into the pocket of his shorts and whipped out a cigarette lighter. As soon as he flicked it, and I saw the spark, I knew what had happened that day in the Fair Deep Mine, and it had nothing to do with the hobnails on my father's boots. Something started to fizz and spark on top of the red ball the ordinary kid was holding. He threw it just to get rid of it, and the bad little kid laughed. Except it was really a deep, snotty chuckle. Like that. It struck the side of the steps, below the iron railing, and bounced back just before it went off with an ear-splitting bang and a flash of yellow light. That wasn't a firecracker or even a cherry bomb. That was an M-80. It startled Carla the way Carla herself must have startled Vicky that day in the box room at Fudgy Acres. I grabbed for her, but she was holding one of Father Patrick's hands in both of hers, and all I did was brush her elbow. They fell down the steps together. He broke his right arm and left leg. Carla broke an ankle and got a concussion, and she lost the baby. She lost Helen. The kid who actually threw the M80 walked into the police station the next day with his mother and owned up. He was devastated, of course, and said what kids always say and mostly mean after something goes wrong. It was an accident. He hadn't meant to hurt anyone. He said he wouldn't have thrown it at all, except the other boy lit the fuse and he was scared he'd lose his fingers. No, he said. He'd never seen the other kid before. No, he didn't know his name. Then he gave the policeman the $5 the bad little kid had given him. Carla didn't want to have much to do with me in the bedroom after that, and she stopped going to church. I kept on, though, and got involved with Conquest. You know what that is, Mr. Bradley, not because you're a Catholic, but because this is where you came in. I didn't bother with the religion part. They had Father Patrick for that. But I was happy to coach the baseball and touch football teams. I was always there for the cookouts and the campouts. I got a D-code on my driver's license so I could take the boys to swim meets, amusement park fun days, and teen retreats in the church bus. And I always carried a gun. The .45 I bought at Wise Pawn and Loan, you know, the prosecution's Exhibit A. I carried that gun for 5 years, either in the glove compartment of my car or in the toolbox of the Conquest bus. When I was coaching, I carried it in my gym bag. Carla came to dislike my work with Conquest because it took up so much of my free time. When Father Patrick asked for volunteers, I was always the first one to raise my hand. I'd have to say she was jealous. You're almost never home on weekends anymore, she said. I'm starting to wonder if you might be a little queer for those boys. Probably I did seem a little queer, because I made a habit of picking out special boys and giving them extra attention. Making friends with them, helping them out. It wasn't hard. A lot of them came from low-income homes. Usually the single parent in those homes was a mom who had to work one minimum wage job or even two or three to keep food on the table. If there was a car, she'd need it. So I'd be happy to pick my current special boy up for the Thursday night Conquest meetings and bring him home again after. If I couldn't do that, I'd give the boys bus tokens. Never money, though. I found out early that giving those kids money was a bad idea. I had some successes along the way. One kid, I think he maybe had two pairs of pants and three shirts to his name when I met him, was a math prodigy. I got him a scholarship at a private school, and now he's a freshman at Kansas State riding a full boat. A couple of others were dabbling in drugs, and I got at least one of them out of that. I think. You can never tell for sure. Another ran away after an argument with his mom and called me from Omaha a month later, right around the time his mother was deciding he was either dead or gone for good. I went and got him. Working with those Conquest boys gave me a chance to do more good than I ever did filing tax returns and setting up tax dodge corporations in Delaware. But that wasn't why I was doing it. Only a side effect. Sometimes, Mr. Bradley, I'd take one of my special boys fishing out to Dixon Creek or to the Big River on the Lower City Bridge. I was fishing, too, but not for trout or carp. For a long time, I didn't feel a single nibble on my line. Then along came Ronald Gibson. Ronnie was 15, but looked younger. He was blind in one eye, so he couldn't play baseball or football, but he was a whiz at chess and all the other board games the boys played on rainy days. No one bullied him. He was sort of the group mascot. His father walked out on the family when he was 9 or so, and he was starved for male attention. Pretty soon he was coming to me with all his problems. The main one, of course, was that bad eye. It was a congenital defect called a keratoconus, a misshapen cornea. A doctor told his mother it could be fixed with a corneal transplant, but it would be expensive, and his moms couldn't afford anything like that. I went to Father Patrick, and between us we ran half a dozen fundraisers called Fresh Sight for Ronnie. We even got on TV, the local news on Channel 4. There was one shot of Ronnie and me walking in Barnum Park with my arm around his thin shoulders. Carla sniffed when she saw it. "If you aren't queer for them," she said, "people will say you are when they see that." I didn't care what people said, because not long after that news report, I got the first tug on my line, right in the middle of my head. It was the bad little kid. I'd finally caught his attention. I could feel him. Ronnie had the surgery. He didn't get all the sight back in his bad eye, but he got most of it. For the first year afterward, he was supposed to wear special glasses that got dark in bright sunshine, but he didn't mind that. He said they made him look sort of cool. Not long after the operation, he and his mother came to see me one afternoon after school in the little conquest office in the basement of St. Andrews. She said, "If there's ever anything we can do to pay you back, Mr. Hallis, all you have to do is ask." I told him that wasn't necessary. It had been my pleasure. Then I pretended to get an idea. "There might be something," I said. "Just a little thing." "What is it, Mr. H?" Ronnie asked. I said, "One day last month I parked behind the church and was halfway down the stairs when I remembered I hadn't locked up my car. I went back and saw a kid inside it, rummaging around. I shouted at him, and he was out like a shot with my little change box, the one I keep in the glove compartment for tolls. I chased him, but he was too fast for me. All I want," I told Ronnie and his moms, "is to find him and talk to him. Tell him what I tell all you boys. Stealing's the wrong start in life." Ronnie asked me what he looked like. "Short and kind of pudgy," I said. "Bright orange hair, a real carrot top." When I saw him, he was wearing gray shorts and a green sweater with stripes the same color as his hair. Mrs. Gibson said, "Oh my goodness, was he wearing a little hat with a propeller on top?" "Why, yes," I said, keeping my voice nice and steady. "Now that you mention it, I believe he was." "I've seen him across the street," she said. "I thought he moved into one of the projects over there." "What about you, Ronnie?" I asked. "Nope," he said. "Never seen him." "Well, if you do, don't say anything to him. Just come and get me. Will you do that?" He said he would, and I was satisfied, because I knew the bad kid was back, and I knew I'd be around when he made his move. He'd want me to be around, because that was the whole point. I was the one he wanted to hurt. All the others, Marley, Vicky, my father, Mama Noni, were just collateral damage. A week went past, then two. I was beginning to think the kid had sensed what I was planning. Then one day, the day, Mr. Bradley, one of the boys ran into the playground behind the church, where I was helping a bunch of them set up the volleyball net. "A kid knocked Ronnie down and stole his glasses," this boy shouted. "Then he ran off into the park. Ronnie's chasing him." I didn't wait.
just grabbed up my gym bag. I took it everywhere with me during the years when I had special boys, and ran through the gate into Barnum Park. I knew it wasn't the bad little kid who stole Ronnie's glasses. That wasn't his style. The glasses stealer would be as ordinary as the M80 thrower, and just as sorry after whatever the bad little kid was planning played out, if I let it play out. Ronnie wasn't an athletic boy, and he couldn't run fast. The glasses-stealing boy must have seen that, because he pulled up short on the far side of the park, waving them over his head and shouting, "Come and get 'em, Ray Charles! Come and get 'em, Stevie Wonder!" I could hear the traffic on Barnum Boulevard and knew exactly what that bad boy was planning. He thought what worked once would work again. It was a pair of special glare-reducing glasses instead of a Steve Austin lunchbox, but the basic idea was the same. Later, the kid who took Ronnie's glasses would cry and say he didn't know what was going to happen. He thought it was just a joke or a tease, or maybe payback for Ronnie pushing the pudgy little carrot top down on the sidewalk. I could easily have caught up with Ronnie, but at first I didn't. He was my lure, you see, and the last thing I wanted was to reel him in too soon. When Ronnie got close, the boy doing the bad little kid's dirty work darted through the stone arch between the park and Barnum Boulevard, still waving Ronnie's glasses over his head. Ronnie ran after him, and I came third. I jogged as I unzipped my gym bag, but once I had the revolver in my hand, I dropped the bag and went into overdrive. "Stay back," I shouted at Ronnie as I ran past him. "Don't you go one step further."
He did what I said, and thank God for that. If anything had happened to him, I wouldn't be here waiting for the needle, Mr. Bradley. I would have killed myself. When I got through the arch, I saw the bad little kid waiting on the sidewalk. He was the same as always. The big kid was handing him Ronnie's glasses, and the bad little kid was handing him a bill. When he saw me coming, he lost the nasty little smirk on those weird red lips of his for the first time, because that wasn't the plan. The plan was Ronnie first, then me. Ronnie was supposed to chase the bad little kid into the street and be hit by a truck or a bus. I was supposed to come last and see it. Carrot Top ran into Barnum Boulevard. You know what it looks like outside the park. At least you ought to, after the prosecution showed their video 3 times at the trial. 3 lanes in each direction, 2 for travel and 1 for turning, with a concrete divider in the middle. The bad little kid looked back when he got to the divider, and by then, he was a lot more than startled. That look was pure fear. Seeing it made me happy for the first time since Carla went upsy-turvy down those church steps. One quick glimpse was all I got. Then he charged into the southbound lanes without a single look to see what might be coming at him. I ran into the northbound lanes the same way. I knew I might get hit, but I didn't care. At least it would be a genuine accident. No mysterious stuck accelerator. You can call that suicidal, but it wasn't. I just couldn't let him slip away. I might not have seen him for another 20 years, and by then I would have been an old man. I don't know how close I came to getting creamed, but I heard plenty of screeching brakes and squalling tires. A car swerved to avoid the kid and sideswiped a panel truck. Someone called me a crazy asshole. Someone else shouted, "What the fuck is he doing?" That was just background noise. I had all my attention fixed on the bad little kid. Eyes on the prize, right? He was running as fast as he could, but no matter what kind of monster he was on the inside, on the outside he was stuck with short legs and a fat ass, and he never had a chance. All he could hope for was that a car would hit me, but none of them did.
He got to the far side and stumbled on the curb. I heard some woman, a stout lady with dyed blonde hair, scream, "That man has a gun!" Mrs. Jane Hurley. She testified at the trial. The kid tried to get up. I said, "This is for Marley, you little son of a bitch," and shot him in the back. That was number one. He started crawling on his hands and knees. Blood was dripping onto the sidewalk. I said, "This is for Vicky," and put another one in his back. That was number two. Then I said, "This is for my dad and Mama Noni," and put a bullet into the back of each knee, just where those baggy gray shorts ended. That was three and four. Lots of people were screaming by then. Some man was yelling, "Get it away from him! Just tackle him!" But no one did. The bad little kid rolled over and looked at me. When I saw his face, I almost stopped. He didn't look six or seven anymore. Bewildered and in pain, he looked no more than five. His beanie had fallen off and lay next to him on its side. One of the two plastic propeller blades was all crooked. My God, I thought, I have shot a blameless child, and he's lying here at my feet, mortally wounded. Yes, he almost got me. It was a good act, Mr. Bradley. Real Academy Award stuff. But then the mask slipped. He could make most of his face all wounded and hurt, but not his eyes. That thing was still in his eyes. "You can't stop me," his eyes were saying. "You won't stop me until I'm done with you, and I'm not done with you yet." "Get the gun away from him, somebody," a woman yelled, "before he murders that child." A big fella ran toward me. He testified too, I believe. But I pointed my gun at him, and he stepped away fast with his hands raised. I turned back to the bad little kid and shot him in the chest and said, "For baby Helen." That was number five. By then, blood was pouring out of his mouth and down his chin. My .45 was an old-fashioned six-shooter, so there was only one bullet left. I dropped to one knee in a puddle of his blood. It was red, but it should have been black, like the goo that comes out of a poisonous insect when you step on it. I put the muzzle of the gun right between his eyes. "This is for me," I said. "Now go back to whatever hell you came from." I pulled the trigger, and that was number six. But just before I did, those green eyes of his met mine. "I'm not done with you," his eyes said. "I'm not. And I won't be until you stop drawing breath. Maybe not even then. Maybe I'll be waiting for you on the other side." His head flopped over. One of his feet twitched and then went still. I put the gun down beside his body, raised my hands, and started to stand up. A couple of men grabbed me before I could. One of them kneed me in the groin. The other punched me in the face. A few more joined in. One was Mrs. Hurley. She got me at least two good ones. She didn't testify about that at the trial, did she? Not that I blame her, Counselor. I don't blame any of them. What they saw lying on the sidewalk that day was a little boy so disfigured by bullets that his own mother wouldn't have recognized him, supposing he ever had one. 7. McGregor took Bradley's client back into the bowels of Needle Manor for the midday count, promising to bring him back afterward. "I'll bring you some soup and a sandwich if you want it," McGregor told Bradley. "You must be hungry." Bradley wasn't. Not after all that. He sat waiting on his side of the plexiglass partition, hands folded on his blank legal pad. He was meditating on the ruination of lives. Of the two under current consideration, the demolition of Hallis's was easier to accept, because the man was clearly mad. If he had taken the stand at his trial and told this story, and in the same reasonable, how-can-you-possibly-doubt-me tone of voice, Bradley felt sure Hallis would now be in one of the state's two maximum security mental institutions instead of awaiting sequential injections of sodium thiopental, pancuronium bromide, and potassium chloride, the lethal cocktail Needle Manor inmates called Goodnight Mother. But Hallis, most likely pushed over the edge of sanity by the loss of his own child, had gotten at least half a life. It had clearly been an unhappy one, beset by paranoid fantasies and delusions of persecution. But to bend an old aphorism, half a life was better than none. The little boy was a far sadder case. According to the state medical examiner, the child who had just happened to be on Barnum Boulevard at the wrong time had been no more than 8, and probably closer to 6. Or 7. That wasn't a life. It was a prologue. McGregor led Hallis back, chained him to his chair, and asked how much longer they'd be. Because he didn't want any lunch. But I wouldn't mind having some. Not long, Bradley said. In truth, he only had one question, and when Hallis was seated once more, he asked it.
Why you?
Hallis raised his eyebrows.
Beg pardon?
This demon, I presume that's what you think he was,
why did he pick you?
Hallis smiled, but it was a mere stretching of the lips.
That's rather naive, Counselor. You might as well ask why one baby is born with a misshapen cornea as Ronnie Gibson was, and the next 50 delivered in the same hospital are just fine. Or why a good man leading a decent life is struck down by a brain tumor at 30, and a monster who helped oversee the gas chambers of Dachau can live to be 100. If you're asking why bad things happen to good people, you've come to the wrong place.
You shot a fleeing child 6 times, Bradley thought. The last 3 or 4 at point-blank range. How in God's name does that make you a good person?
Before you go, Hallis said, let me ask you something. Bradley waited. Have the police identified him yet? Hallis asked in the idle tone of a prisoner who is just making conversation in order to stay out of his cell a little longer. But for the first time since this lengthy visit began, his eyes shone with real life and interest.
I don't believe so, Bradley replied carefully.
In fact, he knew they hadn't. He had a source in the prosecutor's office who would have given him the child's name and background well before the newspapers got hold of it and published it, as they were, of course, eager to do. Unknown Boy Victim was a human interest story that had gone nationwide. It had died down in the last 4 months or so, but following Hallis's execution, it would certainly flare up again.
I'd tell you to think about that, Hallis said, but I don't need to, do I? You've been thinking about it. It probably hasn't been keeping you up at nights, but yes, you've been thinking about it.
Bradley didn't reply. This time Hallis's smile was wide and genuine.
I know you don't believe a word of what I've told you, and hey, who could blame you? But just for a minute, engage those brains of yours and think about it. This was a white, male child, the sort of kid most apt to be missed, and eagerly sought after in a society that still values white male children above all others. The kiddies are fingerprinted these days as a matter of course when they start school,
to help ID them if they're lost, murdered, or abducted. I believe in this state, it's even a law. Or am I wrong?
You're not, Bradley said this reluctantly. But it would be wrong to make too much of it, George. This kid happened to fall through the cracks, that's all. It happens. The system is fallible.
Hallis's smile became a full-fledged grin.
Keep telling yourself that, Mr. Bradley. You just keep telling yourself that.
He turned and waved to McGregor, who removed his earbuds and got to his feet.
All done?
Yes, Hallis said.
He turned back to Bradley as McGregor bent to unchain him. His grin, the only one Bradley had ever seen on his face, was gone, as if it had never been.
Will you come? When it's time,
I'll be here, Bradley said.
8. And so he was. 6 days later, when the curtains in the observation room drew back at 11:52 a.m. to reveal the death chamber with its white tiles and Y-shaped table. Only two other witnesses were present. One was Father Patrick of St. Andrews. Bradley sat with him in the back row. The district attorney was all the way down front with his arms folded across his chest and his eyes never leaving the room on the other side of the window. The execution party, a grotesque term if ever there was one, Bradley thought, was in place. There were 5 in all, Warden Toomey, McGregor and 2 other guards, a pair of medical personages in white coats. The star of the show lay on the table, his outstretched arms secured by Velcro straps. But when the curtains opened, Bradley's eye was first taken by the warden, who was weirdly sporty in an open-necked blue shirt that would have been more appropriate on the golf course. Wearing a seatbelt around his waist and a 3-point harness over his shoulders, George Hallis looked more ready to zoom off in a space capsule than to die by lethal injection. As per his request, there was no chaplain, but when he saw Bradley and Father Patrick, he raised one hand as far as the wrist straps would allow, in a gesture of recognition. Patrick raised a hand in return, then turned toward Bradley. His face was paper pale.
Have you ever attended one of these?
Bradley shook his head. His mouth was dry, and he didn't trust himself to speak in a normal tone of voice.
Me either. I hope I'll be all right.
Father Patrick swallowed.
He was very good to all the children. They loved him. I just can't believe. Even now, I just can't believe.
Bradley couldn't either. Yet he did.
Had to.
The DA turned to them, frowning like Moses above his crossed arms.
Zip your lips, gentlemen.
Hallis looked around the last room he would ever inhabit. He seemed bewildered, as if he wasn't quite sure where he was or what was happening. McGregor laid a hand on his chest in a comforting gesture. It was now 11:58. One of the white coats, an IV tech, Bradley assumed, cinched a length of rubber tubing around Hallis's right forearm, then slipped in a needle and taped it down. The needle was attached to an IV line. The line went to a wall console, where 3 red lamps burned above 3 switches. The second white coat moved to the console and clasped his hands before him. Now the only movement in the death chamber came from George Hallis, who was blinking his eyes rapidly.
Are they doing it?
Father Patrick whispered.
I can't tell.
I can't either, Bradley whispered back.
Maybe, but
there was an amplified click that made them both jump. The state's legal representative remained as still as a statue.
The warden said, "Can you folks hear me okay in there?"
The DA gave a thumbs up and crossed his arms again. The warden turned to Hallis.
"George Peter Hallis, you have been condemned to death by a jury of your peers, a sentence affirmed by this state's Supreme Court and the Supreme Court of the United States of America."
Like they ever said balls about it one way or the other, Bradley thought.
"Do you have any last words before sentence is carried out?"
Hallis began to shake his head, then appeared to change his mind. He peered through the glass and into the observation room.
"Hello, Mr. Bradley. I'm glad you came. Listen, okay? I'd watch out if I were you. Remember, it comes as a child."
"Is that it?"
the warden asked almost jovially. Hallis regarded the warden.
"One more thing, I guess. Where in the Christ did you get that shirt?"
Warden Toomey blinked as if someone had suddenly flicked cold water in his face, then turned to the doctor.
"Are you prepared?"
The white coat standing beside the panel nodded. The warden recited a mouthful of legal rigmarole, checked the clock, and frowned. It was 12:01 p.m., which made them a minute late. He pointed to the white coat like a stage director cueing an actor. The white coat flicked the switches, and the three red lights turned green. The intercom was still open, and Bradley heard Hallis paraphrase Father Patrick.
"Is it happening?"
No one answered. It didn't matter. His eyes closed. He made a snoring sound. A minute passed. Another long, ragged snore, then 2 minutes, then four. No snores and no movement. Bradley looked around. Father Patrick was gone. 9. A cold prairie wind was blowing when Bradley left Needle Manor. He zipped his coat and stood taking long breaths, trying to get as much outside as possible into his insides, and as fast as he could. It wasn't the execution, per se. Except for the warden's bizarre blue shirt, it had seemed as prosaic as getting a tetanus shot or a shingles vaccination. That was actually the horror of it. Something moved at the corner of his eye in the chicken run, where the condemned prisoners took their exercise, except there wasn't supposed to be anyone there. Exercise periods were canceled on days when an execution was scheduled. McGregor had told him this. And sure enough, when he turned his head, he saw the chicken run was empty. Bradley thought, "It comes as a child." He laughed. He made himself laugh. It was just a well-deserved case of the whim-whams, no more than that. As if to prove it to himself, he shivered. Father Patrick's elderly Volvo had departed. There was no car but his own in the small visitor's parking lot adjacent to Needle Manor. Bradley walked a few steps in that direction, then whirled suddenly toward the chicken run, the hem of his overcoat flapping around his knees. No one there. Of course not. Jesus Christ. George Hallis had been mad, and even if his bad little kid had been real, he was dead now. 6 shots from a 45, pretty much guaranteed dead. Bradley resumed walking, but when he got around the hood of his car, he once more came to a halt. An ugly scratch ran all the way from his Ford's front bumper to the rear left taillight. Someone had keyed his car. In a maximum security prison where you had to pass 3 walls and a like number of checkpoints, someone had keyed his car. Bradley's first thought was of the DA, who who had sat there with his arms crossed over his chest, a portrait of Talmudic self-righteousness. But the idea had no logic to support it. The DA had gotten what he wanted, after all. He had watched George Halas die. Bradley opened the car door, which he had not bothered to lock. He was in a prison, after all, and stood, stock still, for several seconds. Then, as if controlled by a force outside himself, his hand rose slowly to his mouth and covered it. Lying on the driver's seat was a beanie with a propeller on top. One of the two plastic blades was crooked. At last he bent and plucked it up, tweezing it between two fingers just as Halas had done. Bradley turned it over. A note had been tucked inside, the letters crooked and bunched together and downslanted. A kid's printing. "Keep it. I have another one." He heard a child's laughter, high and bright. He looked toward the chicken run, but it was still empty. He turned the note over and saw another, even briefer, communique. "See you soon."
For Russ Doerr. In The Hair of Harold Rue, probably the best novel about writing ever published, Thomas Williams offers a striking metaphor, maybe even a parable, for how a story is born. He envisions a dark plain with a small fire burning on it. One by one, people come out of the dark to warm themselves. Each one brings a little fuel, and eventually the small fire becomes ablaze with the characters standing around it, their faces brightly lit, and each beautiful in its own way. One night as I lay drifting toward sleep, I saw a very small fire, a kerosene lantern, in fact, with a man trying to read a newspaper by its light. Other men came with their own lanterns, casting more light on a dreary landscape that turned out to be the Dakota Territory. I have visions like this frequently, although it makes me uneasy to admit it. I don't always tell the stories that go with them. Sometimes the fire goes out. This one had to be told because I knew exactly what kind of language I wanted to use. Dry and laconic, not like my usual style at all. I had no idea where the story was going, but I felt perfectly confident that the language would take me there. And it did.
A Death, read by Cotter Smith.
Jim Truesdale had a shack on the west side of his father's gone-to-seed ranch, and that's where he was when Sheriff Barkley and half a dozen deputized townsmen found him, sitting in the one chair by the cold stove, wearing a dirty barn coat and reading an old issue of the Black Hills Pioneer by lantern light. Looking at it, anyway. Sheriff Barkley stood in the doorway, mostly filling it up. He was holding his own lantern. "Come out of there, Jim, and do it with your hands up. I ain't drawn my pistol and don't want to." Truesdale came out. He still had the newspaper in one of his raised hands. He stood there looking at the sheriff out of his flat gray eyes. The sheriff looked back. So did the others, four on horseback and two on the seat of an old buckboard with Hines Mortuary printed on the side in faded yellow letters. "I notice you ain't asked why we're here," Sheriff Barkley said. "Why are you here, Sheriff?" "Where's your hat, Jim?" Truesdale put the hand not holding the newspaper to his head, as if to feel for his hat, which was a flat brown plainsman and not there. "In your place, is it?" the sheriff asked. A cold breeze kicked up, blowing the horses' manes and flattening the grass in a wave that ran south. "No," Truesdale said, "I don't believe it is."
"Then where?"
"I might have lost it."
"You need to get in the back of the wagon," the sheriff said.
"I don't want to ride in no funeral hack," Truesdale said.
That's bad luck.
You got bad luck all over, one of the men said. You're painted in it. Get in. Truesdale went to the back of the buckboard and climbed up. The breeze kicked again, harder, and he turned up the collar of his barn coat. The two men on the seat of the buckboard got down and stood either side of it. One drew his gun, the other did not. Truesdale knew their faces, but not their names. They were town men. The sheriff and the other four went into his shack. One of them was Hines the Undertaker. They were in there for some time. They even opened the stove, which was unlit in spite of the cold evening, and dug through the ashes. At last, they came out. No hat, Sheriff Barkley said. And we would have seen it. That's a damn big hat. Got anything to say about that? It's too bad I lost it. My father gave it to me back when he was still right in the head. Where is it, then? Told you I might have lost it, or had it stoled. That might have happened, too. Say, I was going to bed right soon. Never mind going to bed. You were in town this afternoon, weren't you? Sure he was, one of the men said, mounting up again. I seen him myself wearing that hat, too. Shut up, Dave, Sheriff Barkley said. Were you in town, Jim? Yes, sir, I was, Truesdale said. In the Chuckaluck? Yes, sir, I was. I walked from here and had two drinks. And then I walked home. I guess the Chuckaluck's where I lost my hat. That's your story. Truesdale looked up at the black November sky. It's the only story I got. Look at me, son. Truesdale looked at him. That's your story. Told you, the only one I got, Truesdale said, looking at him. Sheriff Barkley sighed. All right, let's go to town.
Why?
Because you're arrested.
Ain't got a brain in his fucking head, one of the men remarked. Makes his daddy look smart.
They went back to town. It was 4 miles. Truesdale rode in the back of the mortuary wagon with the collar of his coat turned up. Without turning around, the man holding the reins said,
Did you rape her as well as steal her dollar, you hound?
I don't know what you're talking about, Truesdale said. The rest of the trip went in silence, except for the wind. In town, people lined the street. At first, they were silent. Then an old woman in a brown shawl ran at the funeral hack in a sort of limping run and spit at Truesdale. She missed, but there was a spatter of applause. At the jail, Sheriff Barkley helped Truesdale down from the wagon. The wind was brisk now and smelled of snow. Tumbleweeds blew straight down the main street and toward the town water tower, where they piled up against a shake pole fence and rattled there.
Hang that baby killer,
a man shouted, and someone threw a rock. It went between Truesdale's head and right shoulder and clattered on the board sidewalk. Sheriff Barkley turned and held up his lantern and surveyed the crowd that had gathered in front of the mercantile. Don't do that, he said. Don't act foolish. This is in hand. The sheriff took Truesdale through his office, holding him by his upper arm and into the jail. There were two cells. Barkley led Truesdale into the one on the left. There was a bunk and a stool and a waste bucket. Truesdale made to sit down on the stool, and Barkley said, No, just stand there. The sheriff looked around and saw the posse men crowding into the doorway. You all get out of here, he said.
Otis, said Dave, what if he attacks you?
Then I will subdue him. I thank you for doing your duty, but now you need to scat. When they were gone, he said, Take off that coat and give it to me. Truesdale took off his barn coat and began shivering. Underneath, he was wearing nothing but an undershirt and corduroy pants so worn the wail was almost gone and one knee was out. Sheriff Barkley went through the pockets of the coat and found a twisted tobacco in a page of the J.W. Sears catalog and an old lottery ticket promising a payoff in pesos. There was also a black marble.
That's my lucky marble, Truesdale said. I had it since I was a boy.
Turn out your pants pockets. Truesdale turned them out. He had a penny and 3 nickels and a folded-up news clipping about the Nevada silver rush that looked as old as the Mexican lottery ticket. Take off your boots. Truesdale took them off. Barclay took them and felt inside them. There was a hole in one sole the size of a dime. "Now your stockings?" Barclay turned them inside out and tossed them aside. "Drop your pants."
"I don't want to."
"No more than I want to see what's in there, but drop them anyway." Truesdale dropped his pants. He wasn't wearing underdrawers. "Turn around and spread your cheeks." Truesdale turned, grabbed his buttocks, and pulled them apart. Sheriff Barclay winced, sighed, and poked a finger into Truesdale's anus. Truesdale groaned. Barclay removed his finger, wincing again at the soft pop, and wiped his finger on Truesdale's undershirt. "Where is it, Jim?"
"My hat."
"You think I went up your ass looking for your hat? Or through the ashes in your stove? Are you being smart?" Truesdale pulled up his trousers and buttoned them. Then he stood shivering and barefoot. Not long ago he'd been at home reading his newspaper and thinking about starting a fire in the stove, but that seemed long ago. "I've got your hat in my office."
"Then why did you ask about it?"
"To see what you'd say. That hat is all settled. What I really want to know is where you put the girl's silver dollar. It's not in your house, or your pockets, or up your poop chute. Did you get feeling guilty and throw it away?"
"I don't know about no silver dollar. Can I have my hat back?"
"No, it's evidence. Jim Truesdale, I'm arresting you for the murder of Rebecca Klein. Do you have anything you want to say to that?"
"Yes, sir, that I don't know no Rebecca Klein."
The sheriff left the cell, closed the door, took a key from the wall, and locked it. The tumblers screeched as they turned. The cell mostly housed drunks and was rarely locked. He looked in at Truesdale and said, "I feel sorry for you, Jim. Hell ain't too hot for a man who'd do such a thing."
"What thing?"
The sheriff clumped away without any reply. Truesdale stayed in the cell for a week, eating grub from Mother's Best, sleeping on the bunk, shitting and pissing in the bucket, which was emptied every 2 days. His father didn't come to see him because his father had gone foolish in his 80s, and in his 90s was being cared for by a couple of squaws, one Sue and the other Lakota. Sometimes they stood on the porch of the deserted bunkhouse and sang hymns in harmony. His brother was in Nevada, hunting for silver. Sometimes children came and stood in the alley outside his cell chanting, "Hangman, hangman, come on down." Sometimes men stood out there and threatened to cut off his privates. Once, Rebecca Klein's mother came and said she would hang him herself were she allowed.
"How could you kill my baby?" she asked, through the barred window. "She was only 10 years old, and 'twas her birthday."
"Ma'am," Truesdale said, standing on the bunk so he could look down at her white, upturned face,
"I didn't kill your baby, nor no one."
"Black liar," she said, and went away. Almost everyone in town attended the child's funeral. The squaws went. Even the two whores who plied their trade in the chuckaluck went. Truesdale heard the singing from his cell as he squatted over the bucket in the corner. Sheriff Barclay telegraphed Fort Pierre, and eventually the circuit riding judge came. He was newly appointed and young for the job, a dandy with long blonde hair down his back like Wild Bill Hickok. His name was Roger Mizell. He wore small round spectacles and in both the Chuckaluck and Mother's Best proved himself a man with an eye for the ladies, although he wore a wedding band. There was no lawyer in town to serve as Truesdale's defense, so Mizell called on George Andrews, owner of the Mercantile, the Hostelry, and the Good Rest Hotel. Andrews had gotten 2 years of higher education at a business school in Omaha. He said he would serve as Truesdale's attorney only if Mr. and Mrs. Klein agreed. "Then go see him," Mizell said. He was in the barber shop, tilted back in the chair and taking a shave. "Don't let the grass grow under your feet." "Well," Mr. Klein said after Andrews had stated his business, "I got a question. If he doesn't have someone to stand for him, can they still hang him?" "That would not be American justice," George Andrews said, "and although we are not one of the United States just yet, we will be soon."
"Can he wriggle out of it?" Mrs. Klein asked.
"No, ma'am," Andrews said. "I don't see how."
Then do your duty, and God bless you, Mrs. Klein said. The trial lasted through one November morning and halfway into the afternoon. It was held in the municipal hall, and on that day, there was snow flurries as fine as wedding lace. Slate-gray clouds rolling toward town threatened a bigger storm. Roger Mizell, who had familiarized himself with the case, served as prosecuting attorney as well as judge. Like a banker taking out a loan from himself and then paying himself interest, one of the jurors was overheard to say during the lunch break at Mother's Best, and although no one disagreed with this, no one suggested it was a bad idea. It had a certain economy, after all. Prosecutor Mizell called half a dozen witnesses, and Judge Mizell never objected once to his line of questioning. Mr. Klein testified first, and Sheriff Barkley came last. The story that emerged was a simple one. At noon on the day of Rebecca Klein's murder, there had been a birthday party with cake and ice cream. Several of Rebecca's friends attended. Around 2 o'clock, while the little girls were playing pin the tail on the donkey and musical chairs, Jim Truesdale entered the Chuckaluck and ordered a knock of whiskey. He was wearing his plainsman's hat. He made the drink last, and when it was gone, he ordered another. Did he at any point take off the hat? Perhaps hang it on one of the hooks by the door? No one could remember. Only I never seen him without it, said Dale Gerard, the barman. He was partial to that hat. If he did take it off, he probably laid it on the bar beside him. He had his second drink, and then he left. Was his hat on the bar when he left? Mizell asked. No, sir. Was it on one of the hooks when you closed up shop for the night? No, sir. Around 3 o'clock that day, Rebecca Klein left her house at the south end of town to visit the apothecary on Main Street. Her mother told her she could buy some candy with her birthday dollar, but not eat it because she'd had sweets enough for one day. When 5 o'clock came and she hadn't returned home, Mr. Klein and some other men searched for her. They found her in Barker's Alley between the stage depot and the Good Rest. She'd been strangled. Her silver dollar was gone. It was only when the grieving father took her in his arms that the men saw Truesdale's broad-brimmed leather hat. It had been hidden beneath the skirt of the girl's party.